We're here to talk about Sabbath.
I'm going to read a passage that will be well known to you. I won't tell you where it's from. You probably, many will know. But I'll tell you afterward. I just want you to hear it, and then I have a simple question for you to sit with a bit. At that time, Jesus said, "I praise you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, because you have hidden these things from the wise and the learned and revealed them to little children. Yes, Father, for this was your good pleasure. All things have been committed to me by my Father. No one knows the Son except the Father, and no one knows the Father except the Son, and those to whom the Son chooses to reveal him. Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." So the question to sit with for a moment is, whose yoke are you wearing? Father, as we explore this theme, we look closely at this gift of Sabbath. Father, I'm going to assume that there's many things going on in each of our lives that are complicated, wearisome, troublesome, burdensome, that if we let ourselves get under the weight of them, it is a very onerous thing. It is hard, it is toilsome, it's lonely. Father, we're coming, help us to be and receive like little children what you want to reveal. You don't reveal it to smart people. We're not going to figure this out on our own, but when we come in that spirit of Abba, Father, we cry to you. You show us things about your ways, about your wisdom, but the ways you engage, the ways you do this, you fit us with a yoke. We don't fit ourselves with it. You do it. God, I pray if anyone has come in today and they realize that the yoke they're wearing doesn't fit, it's not yours, that in this brief time we have, Father, there would be a running to you to have you lift that off of them, put upon them that which is easy and light. That they learn from you. So I pray these things for your glory's sake. I pray them in your name. Amen. So in 2001, I was in pastoral ministry. I pastored from 1995 until the summer of 2013. And 2001, I was crashing. I was crashing because I was rushing, I was pushing, I was doing more than I could ask or imagine. It was an exciting time. I was just publishing my first book. I was getting invitations to speak on the strength of that writing. And the church was growing very rapidly, so rapidly that we could hardly keep up. We were in a building program, we were hiring people. It was very exciting, except I was dying. I simply didn't, I didn't have capacity. And so there was these two selves, maybe you've experienced that, the self that showed up on Sunday was very winsome and charming and articulate, and the self that my wife got, my kids got, reclusive, angry, bitter, sad, scared. And finally, it translated into an anger toward God, that I felt that God had, you know, with Jeremiah complains to God, I think it's Jeremiah 20, you know, you tricked me, you deceived me, you gave me a job that I can't do. And I felt very angry that God had called me into something that clearly I wasn't gifted for, or I wasn't called to, and I was just confused and hurting, and went to God and asked for a new yoke. Now, what I understood in asking that was a new job. Either it was a new church or it was a nice plum faculty position at Ambrose or something, but it was get me out of this situation that I can't handle anymore, get me into a smaller church or a better staff or whatever. And the Lord showed me that a yoke is not an assignment. A yoke is a tool. I didn't grow up on the farm, so it took a little bit of whacking over the head to get that point. But nobody puts a yoke on an animal, on a horse or a cow or an ox, and says, there's your job, carry the yoke. The yoke is the tool for doing the job, which is pulling the wagon or pulling the plow. And as I pressed into that image and studied about it, if you have an ill-fitting yoke, the yoke becomes the work. The tool becomes the work. The way you're doing the work becomes the work. It's like if you have a very dull saw, this saw becomes the work rather than the tool by which you do it. And the Lord showed me that the yoke that I was using, it was ill-fitting, and so I was expending virtually all my energy in trying to maintain or trying to wrestle with the yoke, the technique, the method, the way I was engaging, which was basically pedal to the metal. Go, 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 and then give the dregs to family. Go, 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 again, be these two people, this sort of Jekyll and Hyde thing. And in my coming to Jesus and saying, okay, I am too stupid to figure this out. All my wisdom and learning has not given me the discernment to figure out how to get out of this predicament. And began to be humbled like a little child. And I want to come back to that little child, because I think there's one thing that's essential to childlikeness that opens up a whole bunch for us, opens up the kingdom. Unless you become like a little child, you will never enter the kingdom. I think the kingdom opens through childlikeness, but there's one thing that's sort of supreme in all of that. I'll come back if I don't throw something at me. And in that coming to Jesus and saying, okay, you show me, you teach me, what he opened up was a Sabbath. And if actually you look, and what I read from was Matthew 11 right at the end. I've hidden it from the wise and learned. I praise you. I only reveal those to whom I choose. But it turns out he chooses to reveal to the little children who are tired. Come to him and say, teach me. And right after, that's the end of chapter 11. In chapter 12, it's the Lord of the Sabbath passage. Disciples going through the grain field, picking grain. Teacher of the law have a hissy fit. Jesus says, don't you know about David? He took bread, you know, consecrated bread, and he was innocent, the priest was innocent, and I am the Lord of the Sabbath. I'm the one who decides the rules on this. And the penny dropped for me where I realized that the number one way God was going to show me a different way of doing what I did is I needed to become a Sabbath keeper. And I was a chief of Sabbath breakers. Chief of them. In fact, I remember one time telling somebody I had been 40 days without a day of rest, and I was bragging. I've been a lot of places in the world, been in a lot of different cultures, different clothing, different food, different language, different everything. But the one thing that I found is universal, it's almost like the international anthem, is I am so busy and I am so tired. I hear it in children, I hear it in old people, I hear it in India, I hear it in Bolivia, I hear it obviously in North America, I hear it in Asia, I hear it everywhere. Go down to Nairobi, I hear it there, etc. And so there's this drivenness and busyness. And I realized that the one thing that I was neglecting, and that really is a sort of a massive neglect, I think, in almost everywhere in the world, is this coming unto Jesus is actually a coming into this place of resting in Him, delighting in Him, centering our life afresh in Him, and actually being still, Psalm 46:10, and knowing that He is God. Psalm 46 begins with, "The Lord is our ever-present refuge and strength." And everything's falling apart, but you can come to Him. And we only really discover that through the practice of stillness. And so my wife and I began stumblingly, awkwardly, clumsily to practice Sabbath. And that was about 15 years ago. And all I can say is it's kind of saved the day for us. We so look forward to our Sabbath. It's 24 hours every time we get our heart back. I don't know if you ever watched the movie or the television show 24, Jack Bauer, this guy that, 24 hours, he saves America from terror several times. They never thank him. They always want to sell him to the Chinese or something, but he does it. And I was watching a season of that, and I realized the original 24 is a Sabbath where God saves us from all of the, what I'm going to describe is a pharaoh-like culture that we're caught in. This kind of constant demand that we produce, that we define ourselves by what we create and what we consume. And in the midst of that, the God of the universe comes and says, "No, that's not who you are. That's not what secures your identity. That's what gives you security. It's your relationship with me." And Sabbath is a premier way God keeps inviting us back in that place of knowing He is God. So let me take you through a bit of that journey. And I want to do that mostly in our time together by looking at the fourth commandment in the Decalogue or the Ten Commandments. Two versions of the Ten Commandments, Exodus 20, Deuteronomy 5. And we're going to look at, there's a variation between the two, and we'll take a look at that as well. But I want you to imagine that moment when Israel got out of Egypt, crossed over the Red Sea, saw all the chariots, the tumult of warriors and chariots all caught up in the sort of surging ocean that comes collapsing into the dry land that God had created. And they're there, and soon after, Moses goes up the hill to go get the Ten Commandments. I want you to reimagine this moment, how it would be perceived by Israel. I don't know if you've seen the movie 12 Years a Slave. Has anyone seen it? It's quite an extraordinary story, true story about Solomon Northrop. A black man living in upstate New York, pre-Civil War, slavery still practiced down the South. He's a free man, he's a gifted musician, he's got a family, he's living a sort of upper middle class life, he's highly educated. He gets duped by a couple of con artists and drugged and bound and sold down South into the plantation. And he ends up with a really, really bad master. And when he first gets, realizes he's been duped and he's being sold into slavery, his number one impulse is to say, "No, I'm a free man, I'm educated, I can write, da da da." And all the other slaves tell him very quickly, "Don't do that, that's going to just get you into more trouble." And so, sure enough, he finds out, if he reveals that he's literate and all of that, that just makes it worse for him. So he plays along and he acts like he's a slave. At the end of the movie, he does get out of slavery. He's 12 years in it. He comes back north and he reunites with his family. His children are now grown, have children of their own. And he stands in the house that they lived in together and he weeps and apologizes. And his family keeps saying, but this isn't your fault. You have nothing to apologize for. And he just keeps saying, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. And I had this epiphany watching it, that 12 years a slave and he's forgotten who he is. He's forgotten his story. 12 years a slave and he's carrying all sorts of false guilt and false, he's got all kinds of false voices in his head. 12 years a slave. And then I went back and I asked, how long was Israel in slavery? 400 years. Can you imagine what that would do to their sense of who they are and whose they are? Their identity, the emotions that they would carry. So 400 years of slavery, and they're standing on the other side of the Red Sea, and the man that brought them out of slavery goes up the hill to talk to the God. Now, they're used to gods. They've had 400 years of familiarity with brutal gods, taskmaster gods, greedy gods, demanding gods, oppressive gods. And so they're going, they're waiting for this man to come down. They're wanting to lapse back into pagan behavior. You know the story. The man comes down with the two tablets, and they're thinking, okay, here it is. We're going to find out what the demands of the new God are. 400 years, all that be washed out of them, all that sense of who he is and who they are. Imagine how they're hearing this as they stand there, and Moses begins with the prologue to the Ten Commandments. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. In other words, we're already in relationship, and I'm the God who initiates things. I already brought you into freedom. What I'm about to tell you has nothing to do with freedom. It has to do with the intimacy of relationship that I want with you. But I've already given it all. And then the next thing they hear is, you shall have no other gods before me. I mean, Nathan, can you imagine these people 400 years living among the brutal gods of Egypt, and they're just being told you can ignore them all. Go poke them in the eye, because you ain't going to bow the knee to those ones anymore. The next thing they hear is, you shall make no idols. They've just come out of a land of idolatry, and all the manipulation and all the magic thinking and all the appeasement and all the kowtowing and all the fear-mongering of idolatry, and now they're told we're done with that. The next thing they hear is, you shall not use my name in vain, which is not so much a prohibition against cussing. It's saying, don't call on me unless you actually want me to show up. You want a relationship? Great. But don't call on me unless you... Because they're coming out of a culture where you invoke the gods in this empty, vain, appeasing, placating, manipulative way. And God's saying, no, it is about a relationship. And then the fourth commandment comes along. And I'm thinking they're jaw-dropping. They're just like, what is this? You shall not work. Mark standing between Kent and Nathan, he's like, that guy's got a speech impediment. Did you hear what I just said? Like, did he say, you shall not work, you shall work? What did he say? I bet you they just fell over. You know that, I think it's in Mark's Gospel, maybe it's in Luke, but after the resurrection, and the disciples are running from the empty tomb, and it says, and they could not believe for joy. This is too good to be true. I bet you they could not believe for joy. Did the God that now we're under, that we don't have to pay attention to any other gods, that we've done with the idolatry, we actually are in a relationship with this God, we call on his name and he shows up, just tell us, you shall not work? Whew, I'm listening, you got my attention. The closest I have come in trying to think through a contemporary equivalent is, imagine the lady in your church who's a single mom, and she's gotten it out. She's working 2.5 jobs just to try to make the ends meet. She's basically minimum wage stuff. She's got 3 kids who she doesn't have the energy to be, to take them to the park and stuff. Dad picks them up every other week and spoils them because he's gone on to buy a nice house and marry a trophy wife. And they get spoiled by him and then wonder why mom doesn't do all these things for them. And she's just living in read that the old 1995 Honda that she drives is going to give up the ghost, and where does she get the money to pay for that? She thinks Christmas is coming again. This is not a happy day for her, because kids want stuff under the tree, and she's just barely making it work. And somebody comes up to her and says, you know what? This is not a way to live. I've got this company, and I would love you to come work for me, and it'll be a great wage and decent hours. And if you need to go home and look after a sick kid, you can do that. We actually have daycare. You can bring your kids here if you need to. And just to kind of get you started, I've got a timeshare in Hawaii. I'm sending you there, all expenses paid. I'll send a nanny along with you. Your kids can go too. And if you need a nap or to go for a walk, she'll look after them and do all the cooking. Can you imagine her saying, what? Did you have a speech impediment? Like, did I just hear what you just said to me? That's, I think, the kind of the gospel, the good news that Israel would be hearing after 400 years of being a slave. You shall not work. And suddenly the God is not defining them, the God of the universe is not defining them by their productivity, which is all pharaonic culture. Actually, the culture of Pharaoh is you're either a producer or you're a consumer, which is kind of similar to culture that I know. And this, suddenly the God breaks in and says, no, that's important, you should work, but that's not what's going to define you. What's going to define you is you're my child. We're in relationship, and I'm the God who rescued you. I'm the God who entered into covenant with you. That's a fundamental reality. And I think Sabbath is the premier gift that God gives to bring us back into that knowledge and memory. I think in many ways Sabbath function in the life of Israel, I think needs to now function in our life as getting us back into the story of who and whose we are. Now, any questions? Because I want to take us through some more stuff in the Ten Commandments, because it's so fundamental and foundational to this. But any thoughts, comments, questions before we plunge into all that stuff?
I guess one of the things I've been just been looking at and going through, did a Bible lesson for my youth last year, we kind of looked at the Ten Commandments as a, like, old covenant, therefore devoid.
Right. Right?
We don't need to follow anymore, but that's not what it says, right?
Right.
Especially if you read Romans 9, where it talks about how the old covenant cost us to sin, and Paul did, but it's still a good covenant, and it's still something we're designed to follow. But I think we kind of picked some of the good things out of there. We're like, oh, tell you, don't steal, don't lie. But we ignore, like you said, there's things like Sabbath, we pretty much wholly ignore that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I understand the abolition of the law in Christ, or the fulfillment of the law is the way Jesus puts it. I've come to fulfill the law. It has two dimensions to it. Ceremonial law, civic law, you know, what we wear, what we eat, is abolished in Christ. So the fulfillment is, I've looked after all that. You don't need to do it. The secondary, or this, not secondary, but the second dimension of fulfillment is I now empower you to live this. So I would say the Holiness Code falls under that, and certainly the Ten Commandments. And I'll come back to this, because you think about, okay, what part of the Ten Commandments do I think are optional? Now, Jesus is going to empower deeper keeping of them by the Spirit. So Paul says, if you live by the Spirit, you don't need the law. Why? Because it's the Spirit life is automatically generating the kind of life that God is looking for. So there's an empowering through Christ to live the law from the heart. So you can go around and not commit adultery, but Jesus says, but if you're looking at women lustfully, you're doing it in your heart, or not murdering, but if you're breathing out this, you know, these contemptuous terms to people. So there's an empowerment in the death and resurrection of Jesus to live these things from the heart. And obviously, you know, they no longer become necessary to somehow acquire our salvation or our holiness. That becomes imparted to us, but now we're freed up to kind of live the life that God dreamed for us. I want you to think about the sequence of the Ten Commandments. Three commandments that preceded are all about God. the six commandments that follow it are all about people. Now, we might nuance the fifth commandment about honoring mother and father as being somehow more foundational to, you know, the life of covenant and the life of discipleship. But nevertheless, those six, honor parents, don't kill, don't covet, etc., are all horizontally related, to socially related, and the first three are theological, they're all vertically. And then the fourth commandment, remember the Sabbath or observe the Sabbath, depending on which version we look at, Deuteronomy or Exodus. Thoughts about, is there any significance to that sequence? Three to do with God, six to do with people in the middle Sabbath.
Personal.
What's that?
Personal.
Okay, personal. Same one.
I feel that the first three, I've always thought the first three were, this is about your relationship with God, how you interact with God.
Yeah.
And the last six to be, this is how you interact with people. And the fourth is, this is you and I spending time.
Oh, lovely. Okay, that's great. So, yeah.
Just very personal.
Yeah.
Like, this is our day.
Okay.
I don't consider the Sabbath to be my day.
It's our day.
It's our day.
Yeah, okay, I like that. That's good. Thank you. Yeah. So.
I don't do very good at keeping it, but that's why I'm here.
Yeah. Any other thoughts? That's good. Thank you.
For me, I've always seen it now, too. But you do say, like, you kind of say the three about God and then there aren't, but I still think they're kind of all related because what that person asked him, what's the greatest commandment? He said, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. He said, second is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. But I think you can almost boil it down to the one, love the God, your God with heart, soul, and mind, because if you love him and he loves his people, he will love his people. So even though the one is, relationship to God, one's relationship
right.
to people, it all comes down to your relationship with God, because if you're not loving God, you can't love people.
Right.
I think it's a very... This covenant that I'm really studying too is really a relationship of friendship.
Mm.
And as you suggest, he's always pursuing us, right? He wants this relationship with us so that we can have a relationship of friendship with him, but also with each other.
Yeah.
And I think if we take away the harshness of the law, we think of it as Galatians 5:1, Christ has become set you free from all of that which you just said. And if we frame it as friendship, as Jesus said in John 15, no one can call you servant, they call you friend. But there's a condition on that friendship.
Mm.
If you love, like I love,
mm-hmm.
you can only do it with your meaning of Father,
mm-hmm.
which is why the first three are so important.
Mm.
I've just really framed that differently now as a friendship covenant.
Mm.
It's that intimate, something that we don't hear a lot about. Do we know how to be a friend of God? I liked it in your book when you referenced Jesus in the boat.
Mm.
When you said maybe Jesus needs us.
Right.
That, I think that's what that covenant is.
Yeah.
That's what this. That's why it's so powerful. We need him, but he needs us to respond in kind.
Yeah.
Right? By being a witness of each other in the second. First to him, so I don't know if that means anything.
That's good.
Yeah.
What I've come to understand about that sequence of the commandments, and I've understand it more experientially than even theologically, is as my relationship with God goes, so goes my Sabbath. So if I am having no other gods before him, there's a soul allegiance and affection for him, or I'm not letting other things capture my heart, and I am not creating idols. I'm not making idols, which is really about reducing God in an attempt to manipulate God. That's what idolatry fundamentally is. I try to make God my size so I can control him. So if I'm maintaining, or I have no other gods before him, I'm not making idols, and I'm not using his name in vain. In other words, I am entering into the friendship. I call upon him with the intent that we will actually walk together, converse together. I will know his heart. He will disclose the things to me. As my relationship with God goes, so my Sabbath will go. That I can only be still and know that he is God if I actually have the sense of this God who can, I can entrust all that stuff to, all the things that weigh upon me, all the burdens at the church or at the university or whatever. Unless the God is, the God I worship and know is big enough, good enough, gracious enough, sovereign enough to deal with all that, I can't rest. In my book on Sabbath, I end with a story about Philip Melanchthon and Martin Luther, who were, you know, friends and sparring partners theologically. And one day, Philip said to Martin, "Martin, today you and I are going to spend the day fishing." And Martin said, "No, Philip, today we're going fishing. Today we're going to spend the day discussing the governance of the universe." And Martin says, "No, Philip, today we're going fishing and we're going to leave the governance of the universe to God." There is a sense in which when we, our relationship with God is not that friendship that you're talking about, that we try to play God. My definition in the book of Sabbath is when we imitate God in order to remember we're not him. So when we're not nurturing that friendship with God, then we try to play God. We try to govern the universe. We try to run it ourselves. We try to run the church. We make ourselves more important to the things than we really are. And we stop trusting God to watch over the city. Remember Psalm 127? Unless the Lord watches over the city, those who watch in vain. Unless the Lord builds a house, those who build in vain. There's a kind of I'm gonna make it all depends on me. It all counts on it's all. If I'm not at the center driving the thing, nothing will happen. So as our relationship with God goes, so our Sabbath goes, and as our Sabbath goes, so our relationship with others goes. That's the thing. Obvious when we're not well rested, when we're not in this place of friendship with God, knowing that I am the one Jesus loves, knowing Jesus loves me, this I know for the Bible tells me so, not living out of that identity in that place, we tend to be angrier, greedier, lustier, those things. I just think of the times when you find people around you, you get angry. Or you want what they have, you get envious or covetous of their stuff, or you start feeling the monster of lust rising up in you. Almost always, it's in a place when you're anxious and stressed. You're not in a place of restfulness. When you're in this place of intimacy with God, and you're able to kind of really enter into the rest of God, the Sabbath gift of God, all that other stuff just starts to wither on the vine. It just doesn't have the same effect or impact or hold on you that it does when we're in a place of weariness. I, as a pastor for 24 years, sat with many people. I sat with pretty much the whole, you know, murderers and adulterers and thieves and the whole thing, as many of you in pastoral ministry have. And as I peel back the backstory of how this person ended up leaving this very, you know, cheating on this beautiful wife, or having a great job but getting greedy and dickering, you know, cheated. What do you call that thing where you dicker the books anyhow to kind of get more and get caught? You know, whatever. Whenever there's greed or lust or whatever, in every instance I can think of, the backstory was this person was under enormous stress and wasn't in a place of intimacy with God or rest in God. So I think that as your relationship with God goes, so your Sabbath go. As your Sabbath goes, so your relationship with others will go. Think about the scope. Let me open up to the Deuteronomy passage. The mere scope of the fourth commandment. So when God says, "Do not murder," which is the sixth commandment, it just says you shall not murder. It doesn't say don't murder your mother-in-law, don't murder your boss, don't murder the neighbor when his cat does stuff in your. It's just a stark, bald command. Listen to what God says about the Sabbath. On it you shall not do any work, neither you, nor your son or daughter, nor your manservant or maidservant, nor your ox, your donkey, or any other animals, nor the alien within your gates, so that your manservant and maidservant may rest as you do. Make sure the animals get it, make sure the help gets it, make sure your kids get it. Make sure that everyone that has you have any kind of influence upon or power over or whatever, make sure that they get a Sabbath. Striking to me that, and I do think that there is that personal dimension, but there's also this very much a social thing in view, that Sabbath is about, if you're the response, if you're the pastor, if you're the father, if you're the employer, then you have a responsibility to make sure that the people that under your care get sufficient rest. Now, again, it's striking to me in the context of the Ten Commandments, but we don't get any other lists of all who should receive this or be somehow exempt from it. So again, we don't get do not covet. We get don't cover your neighbor stuff. But we don't get don't kill this person, that person, the other person. Just don't kill. But this is this long list of making sure nobody gets missed. So there's something about God's heart for the people that we might be tempted to miss, like the manservants and the maidservants. And if you have any influence on that, God's saying, make sure they get it too. The third thing is the word count. Now this is the most striking to me because, again, you get to those last few commandments and it gets pretty succinct, pretty terse. Do not kill, do not covet, do not steal. The Sabbath commandment is in the Deuteronomy's version, NIV, 133 words. It takes up a third of the Ten Commandments. Thoughts? God goes on and on and on. It just gets chatty. But it would seem like he's trying to get our attention. And the one point I didn't make, but it does have a prohibition at you shall not work, but it doesn't begin that way. It begins with observe the Sabbath, or in Exodus, remember the Sabbath. In other words, it begins as invitation, not prohibition. The way I might illustrate this is say, Nathan, my glasses are some bad thing. It's, you know, this is murder, adultery and stuff. And the way it comes is God says, Nathan, don't go near this, don't touch it, don't look at it, don't do this. Stay away. Sabbath, he says, invitation. So the language shifts when we start discussing Sabbath, and then God says, oh, and make sure that your cat gets it, make sure your daughter gets it, make sure your employees get it, make sure your staff get it, make sure the people in your church get it, make sure everybody gets that thing. Yeah. It's important. God's trying to get our attention. Now, one last thing about that. Turns out, only three commandments have a rationale, a reason why we should do them. The idolatry commandment, the honoring parent commandment, and the Sabbath commandment. The Sabbath commandment has not one rationale, but two. There's one in Exodus and one in Deuteronomy, and they're different, very different. Exodus says you can keep Sabbath because of the creation. For 6 days I created, and then I didn't, so you follow suit. Deuteronomy doesn't mention creation, it mentions the Exodus. For you were slaves in Egypt. I'll read the exact thing. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt, and that the Lord your God brought you out of there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore the Lord your God has commanded you to observe the Sabbath. What do you make of this? That there's not one reason, but two reasons we should keep the Sabbath. First, pointing back to creation, the second, pointing back to the Exodus experience. Any thoughts?
order to do big things, or after we've done big things, you often need to recuperate.
Okay.
There is a need for
resting after creating.
Resting after
getting out of Egypt.
Moving. Right?
Yeah, right. That's great.
400 years.
400 years. Yeah. Yeah.
But I think some of that comes down to a couple of things. It's not just a resting in terms of, ooh, let's just take a nap for 4 hours. But it's saying, rest. Consider what you've just done.
Mm.
Consider, like, I guess it's like a chance for us to even like look what we've done, figure out how we can could do better, or you know,
right.
Just sort of reflect. That's a reflection, right?
Mm-hmm.
I imagine.
Well, I think there's rest about mentioned in the creation account, wasn't it? And after all, it's God rest.
Yeah.
So
and bless the Sabbath.
Cessation of activity.
Yeah. Which is the root sense of Sabbath. Sabbath originally doesn't describe a day of the week. It describes cessation, stop.
For me, I found it interesting too, because sometimes we like to say, "Well, oh, what is Sabbath?" On the Sabbath, well, just don't work that day. You don't just run home and spend some downtime, which is good. But at the same time, Christ worked on Sabbath, quote unquote.
Yeah, I want to come back to that. Thank you.
So, what is it? It's not just a cessation of activity. It's not just don't do this. I feel it is like don't do something that furthers what we might consider earthly gain.
I'm wondering if the story of Sabbath is a microcosm of the story of God. When the story of God is creation and redemption. The story of Sabbath
creation.
Is creation and redemption.
Yeah.
And so it's almost like it in of itself is a hard core of what the bigger story is. And we discover the bigger story.
Yeah.
But we discover.
Brilliant.
This story.
Here, brilliant. I that's what I'd say is a fundamental thing. While we have a double rationale, is that the two grounding stories, not just of Israel, but you and me, is creation and redemption. The story of you are made in the image of God. You're an image bearer of God set upon this earth to reflect Him back to Him in glory and to do that which He set you to do. And when we all got in trouble, He had to come with a mighty hand and outstretched arm to get us out of there so that He could reclaim us as His people. And so the story is that we are God's creation and we are God's precious, you know, we're the redeemed. We're the redeemed of the Lord. This is the grand story that overarches your life and mine. It undergirds it. It surrounds it. I believe that Sabbath is a premier gift God gives us to come back into the bigness of the story. That if we don't actually have a practice of stillness, we'll start living a lesser story and therefore start embracing a lesser identity. I think we'll start believing Pharaoh. We're consumers and we're producers, and our whole identity and sense of worth and security will get bound up in that, rather than, no, we are the beloved children of God who He made in His image, called to His work and His world, and when it all went south, He came and by His blood brought us back, set us back in the way of the Lord. And we'll start living the lesser story. Will Willimon, I don't know if you know that name, but he was here last year on campus doing some lectures, and he didn't tell this story, but I remember him telling this another time I heard him. And he was a bishop, a Methodist bishop of a bunch of churches in the Carolinas, mostly North Carolina. And some of them were black churches, and he'd go to these black churches, and the services would be endless. They'd just go on and on and on. And he was at one, it was almost a 4-hour service, and he went to the pastor after, and he said, why do you meet for so long? And the pastor said, well, you see, my people go out into the world and they work at jobs. They work them to the bone and pay them hard to nothing. And they're told they have no other worth except that which they produce. And they come here Sunday and I just need a little time to remind them who they really are. And Sabbath has got, I need a little time. I need about 24 hours to remind you who you really are. Bring you back into the big story of your identity. You are created, you are the redeemed. And I want you to live out of that identity, because everything else will be beneath your dignity.
and you'll start believing Pharaoh. You know, when Jesus went into the desert, I love the way Mark captures the language. He's standing there, he's being baptized by John, the sky opens, the heavens open, the dove descends, and just before he goes into the desert, the Father speaks. Remember what he says? You are my son, whom I love. With you I am well pleased. Now, as far as ministry goes, Jesus hasn't done a lick, hasn't turned bread into, hasn't multiplied breads and loaves, hasn't walked on water, hasn't multiplied, turned water into wine, he hasn't raised the dead, he hasn't healed the sick, he hasn't preached a sermon, he's done nothing that we might think would be the thing pleasing the Father. But the Father says, you're mine, I love you, with you I'm well pleased. Goes into the desert, the devil meets him at the tail end. Now Matthew catches the language that echoes the Mark language. So the temptations in Matthew are phrased like this: if you are the Son of God, turn these stones into bread, or jump from the tower. In other words, if you are the one that God loves, if you are the one belonging to God, you'd better go do something. I think, actually, the fundamental temptation of Jesus is which voice would he believe? I think the three temptations are nothing compared with the fundamental temptation. Am I going to believe the voice that I heard going into the desert, or the voice I'm coming out? Am I going to define myself by simply the Father's expression of his love and favor and blessing on me? Or am I going to believe that voice that says, if you are, you better go and prove it? I think that's the great struggle of discipleship. Which voice will you believe?
It's a difference between X and fruit.
Yeah. And so I think Sabbath is this thing, come and receive. I said receive. Oh, I talk about child like this. The number one thing about a child is a child is receptive. It's the number one thing. Unless you become like a little child and never enter the kingdom. I have hidden these things from the wise and learned, but revealed in little children. The number one thing about a child is receptive. Let me illustrate. This January, I was teaching a preaching class, and there was a guy on campus been preaching, teaching homiletics, preaching at an institution in Vancouver for 32 years. He was on campus. I invited him to come and do the lecture. It was great. In the lecture, he was talking about what is the essence of childlikeness? If Jesus says you have to become like a little child, what's the essence of childlikeness? And he says, is it, innocence? And, anyone who's at a two-year-old knows that can't be the answer. Is it wonder? Is it, thankfulness? Is it all these things? And he said, no, if you go to Luke's gospel, Luke 18, I think it's verse 17, Luke 18 somewhere, I think it's verse 17, says, unless you receive the kingdom like a little child, you shall never enter it. And then he did the thing. He went, reached in his pocket, and he pulled out, sorry, I don't have a $20 bill, but pretend this is. And he went over to my oldest student, Norm, who's 67. And I know you're not the oldest person in the room, Heather, but he's the nearest. And he said, Norm, I'd like to give you this. And Norm sat there like this. And he said, Norm, are you going to take it? I'd like to give it to you. And Norm said, why? He said, well, I just want to give this to you. Well, I'll give it back to you at the end of the class. Well, no, you won't. I'm giving it to you. So very reluctantly, he reaches out like it's a dead fish. 3 days old. Takes it, puts it on the side of the desk, puts it in his pocket, puts it there. I'll see it, and he hasn't really touched it. He hasn't really taken it. And he says again, I'll give it back to you at the end of the class. He says, Norm, I've given it to you. It's yours. Well, what do you want me to do with it? That's up to you, it's yours. Okay, I'll do something good. Well, whatever you want. At the end of the class, Norm goes up and actually tries to give it back to him. Won't take it. Now, this man, his name's Stephen, says, he says, I have been doing this illustration for 32 years since he's been teaching preaching. He says, I've given away thousands of dollars. I used to give $5, and then that seemed cheap, and then started giving 10. Now, it's $20 bills, and I hope I can retire and stop doing it before I get into the 50s. But he said, in all the 32 years of giving away thousands of $20, 5, 10, $20 bills, he says, only once when I tried to give it to an adult did I have
somebody eager to accept. Every other person, every other adult had the same similar pattern of response that Norm did. Reluctance, you know, almost grudging and taking it, trying to give it back, promising noble things with it. He says, however, anytime there's a child in the room, I go to the child. He says, what do you think the response is?
Yay.
In fact, he says, as soon as I pull it out, I have kids going. And the one who gets it, can't believe it, snatch it from me. And their only fear is that I will ask for it back or that their parents will tell them what to do. Now, listen to the passage. Unless you receive the kingdom like a little child, you will never enter. I have to say it was an epiphany that day. All sorts of things went off because I realized I'm the quintessential. What do you want me to do? Why? I'll give it back. I'll do noble things. Instead of saying, really? You're giving this? I think the number one thing about Sabbath is a spirit of receptivity. If the God of the universe came to you, Evan, he said, here, take it, it's yours. My gift. Love you. And in it, I will do things. I will meet you in ways and I'll restore you and you'll come back in with a grand story of who and whose you are, but just take it. You shall not work. I want to capture if I have a crusade on, it's to capture for, especially the evangelical church, the delight in the gift of the Sabbath. Did you ever see the best of the Christmas Carol movies, 1953? Alistair Sim stars as Ebenezer Scrooge. And it's magnificent. I watch it almost every year. And this, you know, this story of this greedy, bitter, wizened up old man, stingy old man, who has these three night visitors and transforms his life and becomes joyful and generous and kind. And anyhow, in the story, as you know, his long-suffering employee, Bob Cratchit, has no idea that he's had this tremendous change of heart and really metanoia, repentance. He sees it all differently. And in the movie, Bob Cratchit is rushing down the street on the day after Christmas, and you can hear the bonging of the clock, and he's going to be about 3 seconds late coming into the office. So he comes in very tippy-toey, very quiet, sneaks up to the coat rack, takes his jacket off, hangs it off, his hat and his scarf hangs it up. He's trying to back into his little cubbyhole, and out of the back office, there's old bitter Scrooge trying to joke on him. Cratchit! Yes, sir. You're late! Sir, I know it was Christmas. No! I don't want to hear this anymore. I have no other option. And you can see this sort of this stricken look in Bob Cratchit's face because he knows he's about to get fired. And then Scrooge says, I have no other option but to give you a raise. And then he begins to laugh and apologizes. He says, Father, I'm so sorry. I was a blind and stupid man, but I'm going to change. I'm going to give you, you know, what you're worth and look after your family. And that wonderful sort of closing line, and Scrooge was good to his word. And even better, yeah. I love it. I cry every time I see it. Yeah, it's this beautiful scene. I want you to think of this gift of Sabbath as the God of the universe saying, I have no other option but to give you the day off. You're just going to get bent and twisted and angry and fearful and all that stuff. You're going to start coveting. You're going to start getting murderous thoughts toward people. I have no other option. I just need to give you this gift. Come unto me and let me give you rest. Let me raise the burden, lift the burden off of you, and put my yoke upon you. I just, more than anything, that's my agenda, is to reframe the thing not as here's five principles or, you know, three ways you should do it or 10 reasons why, but this is the gift. And why would you turn down the raise? Why would you turn down the great job and the trip to Hawaii with a nanny? This is the gift that God has given you.
All I can say, and I need to be wrapping up. By the way, I need to run out to a doctor's appointment, so I don't really have time to linger. But my wife and I, as I say, started haltingly, clumsily practicing Sabbath about 15 years ago, and it's become a centerpiece of our spiritual formation. And rabbis, in some rabbinical commentary, they often sort of set up themselves up with a question so that they can give an answer. And the question is, why in one version of the commandments, the Deuteronomy, are we told to observe the Sabbath, and in the other told to remember it? And the rabbi said, it is because we live half the week in anticipation, observing, looking forward, seeing the thing, and the other half living in remembrance, delighting, savoring the memory of the thing. And that's really how it's become for us, is we live this sort of, this, you know, this after the Sabbath, the sense of, oh, that was good, that was, and then as we sort of move through Hump Wednesday or whatever, this next part is then in anticipation that things come in again. One thing that's been gold for me especially, but my wife as well, is in Peter Scazzaro's book, Emotional Healthy Spirituality, which I do recommend for any of you in ministry. But in that book, he describes Sabbath as snow day. Do you remember that? And now when I lived in Vancouver, and this meant a lot more to me because we didn't have too many of them, but when we did have a snow day in Vancouver, it virtually shut down everything. So I'd go to bed and there'd be little flakes falling in the lamplight, and wake up, and sometimes there'd be 3 feet of snow lying on the ground, and heavy snow, not this stuff you can broom away like here. It would be like concrete. And I would look out the window at that 3 foot of snow just burying everything. And my first response would always be, oh no. And then right on the heels of it would be, oh yay. And you'd know that everything was canceled. That all your appointments were off, that the thing you had to go do on the other side of town was, you didn't have to. You might call the person out of a courtesy, but everybody knew it was, they're in the same situation, it was a snow day. Scazzaro says, by divine decree, you get 52 a year. Well, you wake up and you receive the day. You just receive it. You receive all the gifts that are in it. The one gift that I think that I would like to leave you with is, and this is coming back to a comment you made, Nathan, about, it's not just about cessation or stopping. And you made this thing that Jesus did a lot of work on the Sabbath. In fact, Jesus' favorite day to heal was the Sabbath. So Jesus takes the concept, Lord of the Sabbath, of rest, and he joins it to restoration. So on my snow days, and I actually, in my day timer, and I keep an old time day timer, and I write snow day every week. That's all I write. And I get up in a spirit of anticipation and receptivity. What do you have, God? I want to meet you afresh. I want to come back in the big story of who and whose I am. I want to worship you. I want to delight in my wife of my youth, who's now like me getting old. I want to call my kids. I want to do all that. But I've learned that because Jesus' favorite day to show up in church or wherever and heal people, he'll raise Lazarus from the dead on the Sabbath, the woman hunched over, the man with a withered hand, on and on and on. We can find many, many healing stories. Is that I try to identify going to the Sabbath, what is withered? What went blind? What went deaf? What got lame? What fell down a pit? Down a, you know, well, what's not functioning in my life? What's wrong with my heart? Where's my relationship with my wife got dry and thin, etc. And I go in not with a demand, but with a sense of joyful expectancy that Jesus may ambush me on the Sabbath. Invite him. I welcome him. Jesus, you know my wife and I are not, you know, our last few conversations have been pretty edgy. And I need you to come and do something in me so that I speak with her with kindness and gentleness and tenderness. Would you come and just do, something fell down a pit. Can you come lift it out, etc. And what I found is that if I enter into the Sabbath, this receptivity, the snow day, the day is mine now, but it's mine particularly to have Jesus kind of come and restore that which got bent and broken in me, that he's very faithful. He's very faithful. And so, receive the day, receive the gift. He wants to give you a raise. Why would you say no to that? Thanks.